Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. Across the country, Americans were glued to the news as the Washington, D.C. sniper attacks unfolded. Days after, reports of random shootings left entire communities living in fear. Something as routine as pumping gas, walking through a parking lot, or stepping outside suddenly felt dangerous. In Kanawha County, West Virginia, people watched from a distance. They mourned the victims, and they sympathized with the terror gripping the nation's capital. But many also found comfort in the belief that such violence belonged somewhere else. This place was where neighbors knew each other, where people felt safe, and where tragedy like that seemed unimaginable. But that sense of security wouldn't last, because before long, the fear that captured the nation's attention would find its way to the Mountain State, shattering the belief that small towns were immune to senseless violence. And for the people of Kanawha County, nothing would ever feel the same again. This is the case of the Kanawha County Sniper. August 10th, 2003. The summer haze hung over Charleston, West Virginia. The heat from the day still lingered in the air, and the glow from the streetlights reflected off the pavement along Bigley Avenue. It was the kind of late summer night that felt ordinary, quiet, predictable. At the Go Mart, customers came and went as they always did. Some stopped for gas, others grabbed a drink before heading home. Traffic moved steadily through the area as another Sunday night wound down. Just before 11 p.m., 44-year-old Gary Carrier stood at the payphone outside the convenience store. Nearby customers paid little attention. There was nothing unusual about a man making a phone call on a warm West Virginia night. Then everything changed. A sharp crack suddenly pierced the humid air. The sound echoed across the parking lot. Customers jumped, some ducked. Others turned towards the noise, unsure of what they just heard. Seconds later, they watched in horror as Gary slumped to the ground. Blood pooled beneath him from a devastating gunshot wound to the head. What had been an ordinary summer evening instantly transformed into a nightmare.
You know, what makes this unsettling, this wasn't a back road or some isolated location. This happened in front of a convenience store with people nearby. So how does someone get shot in a public place like this? Nobody knows where the shot came from.
That's exactly the question investigators were asking. Standing in the parking lot, surrounded by flashing emergency lights and stunned witnesses, police had to determine whether this was a targeted attack, a random act of violence, or something even more frightening. A man had been murdered. The investigation would begin, and eventually, they would find answers. At least, that's what they hoped. But what no one knew that night was that Gary Carrier's death wasn't the end of the story. In fact, it may have only been the beginning, because just days later, another gunshot would ring out in Kanawha County. 4 days later, fear struck again. August 14th, 2003. The summer heat still clung to the Kanawha Valley as darkness settled over Campbell's Creek at 10:20 p.m. The Speedway station on Campbell's Creek Drive was illuminated by the familiar glow of gas pumps and fluorescent lights. For 31-year-old Jeannie Patton, it was supposed to be a routine stop. She pulled her Pontiac Trans Am to the pump and began filling her tank. likely focused on the rest of her evening ahead of her. Around her, life continued as normal. Cars passed along the roadway, customers came and went. Then, without warning, a gunshot shattered the night. The bullet struck Jeannie in the head. She collapsed beside her vehicle before anyone could comprehend what happened. Chaos erupted across the gas station. Witnesses rushed towards the scene. Among them was Sandy Clay, a former nurse who immediately sprang into action. Kneeling beside Jeannie, she desperately began performing CPR, fighting to save the young woman's life. But her injuries were simply too severe. Despite every effort, Jeannie Patton died within minutes.
By this point, people had to be asking themselves if this was really a coincidence. Just 4 days earlier, Gary Carrier had been shot and killed while standing outside a convenience store. Now, another person is dead at a gas station. Were investigators beginning to think these cases could be connected?
They absolutely were. At first, detectives were cautious. After all, homicides happen for different reasons. Different victims, different circumstances. But the similarities were becoming impossible to ignore. Both attacks happened at night. Both victims were in public places. Both appeared to be going about ordinary activities when they were suddenly shot without warning. And perhaps, most terrifying of all, neither victim appeared to have done anything to attract attention. As news of Jeannie Patton's murder spread across Kanawha County, a chilling realization began to take hold. This wasn't looking like random violence anymore. It was beginning to look like someone was hunting strangers. And if it was true, the next questions were simple. Who would be next?
Hey everyone, I'm Alex, and I'm from APAW Unsolved in West Virginia. I'm a missing persons advocate with a background in criminal justice and psychology, and this channel was created to bring attention to the missing and murdered cases that deserve to be remembered. Here we talk about real people, real families, real stories that still need answers. I spend time researching these cases, speaking with families, and sharing the stories of victims from West Virginia and surrounding areas in hopes of bringing more awareness to cases that are often forgotten. Some of these families have spent years searching for answers. Some are still waiting for someone to come forward, and sometimes all it takes is one person hearing a story to make a difference. If you care about true crime, advocacy, and helping keep these cases in the public eye, make sure to subscribe to APAW Unsolved in West Virginia on YouTube and follow me on Facebook. Together, we can help make sure these stories are never forgotten.
If the murder of Jeannie Patton had investigators on edge, what happened next sent shockwaves through Kanawha County. Just over an hour after Jeannie was gunned down at a Speedway station on Campbell's Creek Drive, another call came in. This time, it was from the Cedar Grove GoMart. The clock read approximately 11:30 p.m. 26-year-old Oki Meadows was outside the store when a single gunshot rang out through the night. Like the victims before, he had no warning, no chance to run, no opportunity to fight back. The bullet struck Oki in the neck, causing catastrophic injuries. Emergency responders rushed to the scene, but there was little they could do. Within a matter of hours, Kanawha County had gone from investigating one mysterious shooting to three separate attacks that appeared eerily connected.
Are investigators starting to think they're dealing with something completely different than the typical homicide? Because three people have been shot at convenience stores and gas stations, and two of those attacks happened less than an hour apart.
That's exactly where the investigation began to change. Experienced detectives known that most murderers follow a familiar pattern. Usually there's a relationship between the victim and the offender, a motive, a grudge, jealousy, revenge, or money. Most homicide investigations begin by asking a simple question: who benefits from this person's death? But as detectives look at the shooting of Gary Carrier, Jeannie Patton, and Oki Meadows, they kept running into the same problem. Nothing connected the victims. Different ages, different backgrounds, different locations, No obvious enemies, no known disputes, no clear reason why any of them would have been targeted. And that's when investigators were forced to consider a possibility that few officers ever encountered during their careers. What if these weren't traditional murders at all? What if someone was selecting victims at random? And the idea sounded more like a plot to a movie or a true crime podcast than a real-life investigation in West Virginia. But with these three shootings within 4 days, including two within little more than an hour, the investigation was becoming impossible to ignore. Somewhere in Kanawha County, a gunman was on the move, and investigators had no idea who he was, where he would strike next, or whether anyone would survive the attack. By now, investigators were facing a question that would determine the direction of the entire case. Were these murders actually connected? At first glance, the answer seemed obvious. Three victims, three shootings, three attacks that appeared to come from nowhere. But police needed evidence, not assumptions. As detectives began comparing the crime scenes, a pattern emerged. All three victims had been struck by gunfire from a distance. Gary Carrier had been shot while standing at a payphone outside a Go-Mart. Jeannie Patton was killed while pumping gas. Okie Meadows had been shot while outside another convenience store less than an hour later. The similarities were impossible to ignore.
So what exactly convinced investigators that they weren't just separate murders happening around the same time?
The ballistics and the shooting circumstances. Investigators determined that all three victims had been targeted with what appeared to be a small caliber firearm. The shooter wasn't standing next to the victims. In every case, the gunman was firing from a distance. Gary Carrier had been shot from approximately 50 to 60 yards away. Jeannie Patton had been shot roughly 30 to 35 yards away. And while the gunman was believed to have been somewhat closer during the attack to Okie Meadows, the shooting still showed signs of a deliberate marksmanship. These weren't impossible shots, but they weren't easy shots either. Police believed it was unlikely that someone could consistently make these kinds of accurate hits with a handgun alone. That led investigators to wonder, was the killer using a rifle? And if so, what kind? To answer that question, bullet fragments recovered from the crime scenes were sent to the FBI for analysis. But while they waited for the lab results, another crucial clue emerged. A vehicle. At the Cedar Grove Go-Mart, witnesses reported seeing a dark-colored, possibly black, extended cab pickup truck parked on the lot before Okie Meadows was shot. Several witnesses remembered it because it seemed out of place. The truck had reportedly remained on the property for nearly 20 minutes, moving from one area of the parking lot to another, as if the driver was watching and waiting. Then came the gunshot. According to witnesses, almost immediately after Okie fell to the ground, the truck accelerated out of the parking lot, spinning its tires as it disappeared into the night.
That doesn't sound like someone who just happened to be there. It sounds like someone who was stalking the scene before the attack even happened.
And that's exactly what investigators began to fear. Even before the FBI completed its ballistics analysis, law enforcement launched a massive manhunt. The stakes were simply too high. If the murders were connected, there was a very real possibility the killer would strike again. Soon, experienced FBI agents, including personnel familiar with the Washington, D.C. sniper investigations, arrived in Kanawha County to assist. A dedicated task force was assembled. Teams of investigators worked around the clock. Some operated during the day, others worked through the night. Every lead was pursued, every witness was interviewed, every suspicious vehicle was checked. Because somewhere out there was a shooter who had already killed three people in a matter of days. And with each passing hour, investigators feared they were racing against time before another shot rang out across Kanawha County. As investigators worked around the clock, they focused on one detail they couldn't ignore. Two of the victims, Jeannie Patton and Okie Meadows, both had ties to the Campbell's Creek area. At first, that seemed significant. Perhaps they knew each other. Perhaps they shared friends, associates, or enemies. Maybe the answer to the case was hidden somewhere in that small community. Detectives began digging into every aspect of their lives. But there was a problem. The deeper they looked, the less connected the victims appeared to be.
So if two of the victims were from the same area, were investigators thinking this might be some kind of local dispute or retaliation?
Absolutely. And in the Kanawha Valley, one possibility quickly rose to the top of the list. Drugs. Investigators know that motive often points directly to a suspect. And all too often, violent crimes can be traced back to drug activity, drug debts, or personal conflicts connected to that world. So detectives began asking the simple question, were any of these victims involved in drugs? And if so, could that explain the shootings? The answer surprisingly appeared to be no. Gary Carrier was a South Charleston resident with virtually no criminal history. Investigators found nothing suggesting ties to drug trafficking or violent criminal activity. His record contained only a handful of minor civil matters, nothing that would make him appear to be a target of a calculated murder. Then there was Oakey Meadows. Detectives examined his background as well. They found a domestic battery conviction that resulted in a probation in 2001 and a previous military-related charge connected to an absence without leave allegation, but both of those charges had later been dropped. More importantly, investigators found no evidence linking Oakey to drugs, and they found no evidence linking him to Gary either.
So at this point, they're looking at these victims one by one and still can't figure out why any of them would be targeted.
Exactly. And then there was Jeannie Patton. Of all three victims, she may have been the most unexpected. 31-year-old Jeannie Patton was a mother. She worked as a substitute cook and janitor for the local school system. Friends and family described a stable life. She had been with her boyfriend for years, helping raise her son. She had no criminal record, no known enemies, no apparent connection to drugs, and no known connection to either Gary Carrier or Oakey Meadows. Investigators were left staring at three victims who appeared to have absolutely nothing in common. No shared social circles, no shared criminal activity, no shared motive, which raised a terrifying possibility. What if they weren't chosen because of who they were? What if they were chosen because they happened to be there? Then, within a week of the murders, investigators received the answer they had been waiting for. The FBI ballistic analysis was complete. Charleston Police Chief Jerry Pauley announced the results publicly. All three victims had been shot with bullets fired from the same exact firearm.
So, this is the moment that goes from theory to a fact?
Exactly. Up until then, investigators suspected the cases were connected. Now they knew. The same gun had killed Gary Carrier. The same gun had killed Jeannie Patton. And the same gun had killed Oakey Meadows. For the first time, police had a direct physical link connecting all three murders. The implications were chilling. Just months earlier, Americans had watched the Washington, D.C. sniper case unfold on national television. Now investigators in Charleston were being forced to ask whether their city was facing something similar. The response was immediate. The task force expanded dramatically. The FBI joined the effort. So did the AFT, the Secret Service, the U.S. Marshals Service, the Kanawha County Sheriff's Department, the Metro Drug Unit, the police departments from Charleston, South Charleston, and St. Albans. Resources poured into the investigation. Tips flooded in. Officers worked around the clock. Because what began as a homicide investigation was now something much larger. Authorities believed a serial shooter was operating in Kanawha County. Nobody knew when or where the next shot would be fired.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
With these three murders linked to the same weapon and a growing sense of fear spreading throughout Kanawha County, investigators made a decision. They needed the public's help. At a packed press conference, members of the Sniper Task Force revealed details that had been closely guarded during the earlier days of the investigation. For the first time, residents learned how much information law enforcement had collected. And listening to the announcement, many people believed an arrest was right around the corner.
So by this point, police actually had a suspect description and a vehicle description, right? Sounds like they were getting pretty close.
It certainly looked that way. Investigators announced that witnesses had reported seeing the same type of vehicle near multiple shooting scenes. According to those witnesses, the vehicle was a black Ford F-150 pickup truck. Not just any truck either. The vehicle was described as having tinted windows, an extended cab, a sliding rear window, and a stripe running along the lower portion of the truck. Even more promising, witnesses also provided a description of a man they wanted police to identify. An artist's sketch was released to the public. The man was described as white, approximately 6 feet tall, with a slender build and a beard. Police urged anyone with information to come forward, and for a brief moment, it felt like the case might finally break open.
I'm guessing that's where things got complicated.
Very complicated. Because while the description sounded specific, investigators quickly discovered a major problem. Finding a black Ford F-150 in Kanawha County was like searching for a needle in a haystack. The truck was one of the most common vehicles on the road. Within days, the task force was flooded with reports. Everywhere people looked, they seemed to spot another black pickup truck. Neighbors reported neighbors, coworkers reported coworkers, strangers reported strangers. Soon, investigators were sorting through more than 400 reports involving possible suspect vehicles. Officers began stopping trucks all across the Kanawha Valley. Each stop carried a sense of hope. Could this be the truck? Could this be the killer? But one by one, the lead came up empty. As the weeks passed, the numbers became staggering. More than 1,000 tips poured into the task force. Some involved possible suspects, others involved sightings of trucks. A few reports of possible new attacks turned out to be frightened citizens reacting to everyday noises. The fear that gripped the community had become so intense that almost any loud sound could spark panic. And despite the massive amount of information being collected, investigators were no closer to identifying the shooter.
So even with all those tips, they still can't figure out why these victims have been targeted?
Exactly. Investigators continued searching for a connection. Anything. A shared workplace, a shared friend, a shared enemy. But every road led to the same conclusion. The victims had nothing in common, except the person who killed them. Months passed. The task force chased down another 1,000 leads. Still nothing. Public attention slowly began to fade. The phone calls that once flooded the tip lines became less frequent. The fear that had consumed the valley began giving way to frustration. In an effort to generate new information, the Kanawha County Commission increased the reward fund to $100,000. Surely someone knows something. Surely someone would come forward. But the silence continued. Then investigators thought they might finally have a breakthrough. In late 2003, attention turned to a man named Brian Caldwell of Winifred. He had already been identified as a person of interest in the sniper investigation. Then another violent incident brought him back into the spotlight. Authorities accused Caldwell of shooting Michelle Phillips and firing multiple rounds at her parked vehicle in the Cabin Creek area. When investigators searched his vehicle, they recovered shell casings connected to the shooting. And there was something else, something that immediately caught investigators' attention. Caldwell owned a black 1997 Ford F-150, the same type of vehicle witnesses had been describing for months.
So this had to feel like the break investigators had been waiting for.
It did. And the more they looked into Caldwell, the more questions emerged. Court records showed that years earlier, a judge had appointed Caldwell's wife as his legal guardian after concerns were raised about his ability to manage his own affairs. Documents described significant mental health struggles, including severe depression and paranoia. Investigators knew that they couldn't ignore those facts. But owning a truck and fitting part of a description isn't the same thing as proving a murder. The question now became, had the task force finally found the Kanawha County sniper? Or was Brian Caldwell simply another lead in a case that seemed determined to stay unsolved? As months passed, Brian Caldwell remained one of the most talked about names connected to the Kanawha Valley sniper investigation. And then, in March of 2004, his legal troubles deepened. Federal authorities arrested Caldwell and charged him with possession of a firearm after being adjudicated mentally defective. The charge stemmed from a bizarre and dangerous incident in the Cabin Creek area. According to investigators, someone had fired shots into a natural gas pipeline, sparking a fire that could have ended in disaster. Witnesses reported a black Ford F-150 leaving the area shortly before the flames were discovered. The description immediately caught investigators' attention.
So now you've got the same type of truck showing up again connected to another shooting incident?
Yeah, and it didn't stop there. The day before the pipeline shooting, a woman named Michelle Phillips reported that a man driving a Ford F-150 pulled alongside her vehicle and opened fire in exchange between the two. Investigators recovered shell casings from both scenes. When those casings were analyzed, they matched the shell casings discovered inside Caldwell's truck. For investigators, it was powerful evidence linking Caldwell to those specific incidents. But the question everyone wanted answered remained the same. Was he also responsible for the sniper murders?
I mean, because from the outside looking in, it sounds like police finally had somebody who fit the profile.
And many people believed exactly that. During court proceedings, AFT agent Donald Sager testified that Caldwell had lied about his mental health history on federal firearm forms used to purchase guns. Authorities also revealed something that stunned the public. When officers searched Caldwell's home, they confiscated 55 firearms and approximately 47,000 rounds of ammunition.
47,000 rounds?
47,000 rounds.
Damn.
It's the kind of number that immediately grabs headlines. And for most residents who had spent months living in fear, it seemed like confirmation that investigators had finally found their man. Eventually, Caldwell was sentenced to 6.5 years in federal prison for illegally possessing firearms and falsifying federal paperwork. Then, in 2005, he received an additional 5-year sentence in Kanawha County after pleading guilty to wanton endangerment in the Michelle Phillips shooting. To many people watching this from the outside, the case appeared closed. The community could finally move on. At least that's what many assumed. But then something unexpected happened. Following Caldwell's sentencing, law enforcement officials held a press conference. Not to celebrate solving the sniper case, the sniper murders remained unsolved.
So after everything, investigators were publicly saying Caldwell wasn't the answer?
That's right. FBI officials wanted to stop the rumors before they spread any further. Joe Cicerelli, the FBI resident agent in charge in Charleston, stood before reporters and delivered a message that many families didn't want to hear. Despite speculation to the contrary, the August 2003 sniper shooting remained unsolved. Investigators still didn't have enough evidence to connect anyone to the murders of Gary Carrier, Jeannie Patton, or Oki Meadows. The $100,000 reward remained active. And for the first time, authorities publicly revealed another important detail. The weapon used in the killings was believed to be a Merlin 22 Magnum rifle. It was one of the most significant pieces of information released since the murders. Yet, even with that knowledge, the case remained stalled. Years later, new theories would emerge. In 2007, public access television host Andy Palmer claimed he had uncovered information suggesting a local group known as the Charleston Five was responsible for the shootings. According to Palmer's unnamed source, Jeannie Patton had been intended target, and the other victims were killed to make the crimes appear random. It was a shocking allegation, but there was one major problem. No evidence ever surfaced to support the claim. No arrests followed, no charges were filed, and those theories ultimately remained that, a theory. But
that's not quite where the story ends, is it?
No, it isn't.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
In 2011, nearly 8 years after the shootings terrorized Kanawha County, a grand jury indicted Sean Lester in connection with all three murders. For families, it was the breakthrough they had waited years to see. Then, in July of 2012, Lester pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and the death of one of the victims. As part of the plea agreement, prosecutors dropped the charges related to the other two murders. He was sentenced to 40 years in prison for the murder conviction and received an additional consecutive 6-year federal sentence on firearm charges.
So after nearly a decade, there was finally an arrest and a conviction?
There was. But even with that conviction, the Kanawha Valley sniper case remains one of the most chilling chapters in West Virginia history. Because for weeks in the summer of 2003, an entire community lived in fear. People avoided gas stations. They watched parking lots more carefully. They looked twice at every black pickup truck they passed. And while a conviction eventually brought answers to investigators, it could never ease the fear, the uncertainty, and the lives that were changed forever. Gary Carrier, Jeannie Patton, in Oaky Meadows. Three victims whose names should never be forgotten, and a case that reminded everyone in the Kanawha Valley that sometimes the most terrifying crimes aren't the ones that happen somewhere else. Sometimes they happen right in your own backyard. We will be off next week, but we will return the following week with a new episode. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.